was in some ways continuing the discussion last week on anger, but really to move into another related area that I've been thinking a lot about lately, which is reconciliation. And last week when I talked about anger, I talked about some of the social factors that come into play with anger. And the issue of anger, I think, is something which often impacts our relationship with other people. And to the degree in which it does that, I think the issue of reconciliation is a very important one. And I've been working on this document that I mentioned last week for the San Francisco Zen Center on their grievance and reconciliation process for their own community. So it's been on my mind a lot, and I thought it might be interesting to share more on that. And so I'll start with a quote from Carl Jung, and I'll talk, kind of repeat some of the things from last week about anger before moving on to reconciliation. And Carl Jung is supposed to have said, "One does not become enlightened by imagining figures of light, but by making darkness conscious, the darkness conscious." And I think that part of why for me mindfulness practice is a sacred practice, is a religious practice, is that what makes it sacred is it's cultivating an awareness which leaves nothing out. And if you have any notion that something is outside of what's acceptable to be aware of, then it's no longer a sacred awareness. And the sacredness of this practice comes from finding an awareness, both the process of finding it and the finding it itself, of an all-encompassing awareness which doesn't try to hold anything out, or doesn't try to hold on to anything. And if you have ever any notion that you're leaving something out, then it's not mindfulness practice. And we have such strong tendencies, many of us, to leave things out of the arena, of the stage of our awareness practice, that often where we have difficulty in our practice is not with what we're conscious of, but what we're kind of trying to keep away. And not necessarily the unconscious, but just something we don't want to kind of allow in onto the stage. So anger is often pointed out for many people is unacceptable, or feelings of aversion or conflict for many people, any kind of conflict. And so you don't want to be involved in that. It's unpleasant. So you want to keep it outside of the field of awareness. And in doing that, you lose the sacredness of the practice. And last week we talked a little bit about, there was some discussion about the word integrity. And one definition of integrity for me is it's our ability or the awareness which leaves nothing outside. So it becomes an awareness which is whole, which is one of the definitions of integrity. It's being complete or being whole. And the tendency to leave things outside of the field of awareness is also a tendency which isolates us from the world. And a lot of the pain and the suffering that comes from leaving different elements or events or feelings of our own or different conflicts or whatever outside, kind of unacceptable to look at, just the very nature of doing that isolates us from that, and therefore from many of our relationships also. And one of the ways which we tend to exclude things from our awareness is through one version of the many varieties of things that's called aversion. And aversion has many varieties. There's anger and resentment. Interestingly enough, in Buddhism, Buddhist psychology, sadness and depression and fear are all considered to be varieties of aversion. Annoyance, complaining, hostility, and so forth. So last week I talked about anger, and that I mentioned that for me, anger is a gate that can open in two directions. And one direction is the direction of increasing isolation, a loss of connectedness, sometimes towards aggression and destructiveness. The other gate that anger presents us with is a gate of understanding. A gate not only understanding, but mutual understanding of the people around us, and therefore lessening the forces of isolation, helping us be more connected with people. And that anger is always a gate. Everything is a gate, we say, in Buddhist practice. But there's a possibility, if you don't turn away from something but turn towards it, that you can find very deep insight and awakening and freedom in that event itself. And And now to repeat myself, to turn away from that possibility, not only is it turning away from opportunity for finding awakening or freedom, but it's also adding, I think, to the isolation, the separateness we can feel from ourselves and the world around us. And these forces of separation are, start at a very young age. We separate ourselves from ourselves. So I thought I'd just read this poem that I've read sometimes before, called Ordinary Heartbreak. And I guess the poet, Deborah Nystrom, added this little quote to the top of her poem by Karen Horney. Narcissism is an expression not of self-love, but of alienation from the self. So the poem goes, she climbs easily onto the box, that seat high above the swivel chair, at adult height, she crosses her legs, left ankle over right, and smooths the plastic apron over her lap, while the beautician lifts her ponytail and mocks, coarse as a horse's tail. Then, as if that's all there is to say, the woman at once whacks off and tosses its foot and a half into the trash. And the little girl, who didn't want her hair cut, but long ago learned successfully how not to say what it is she wants, who even at this minute cannot quite grasp her shock and grief, is getting her hair cut. For convenience, her mother puts it, the long waves gone that had been evidence at night, when loosened from their clasp, she might be secretly a princess. Rather than cry out, she grips her own wrist and looks at her mother in the mirror. But a mother is too polite or too reserved or too indifferent to defend the girl. So the girl herself takes up indifference, while pain follows a hidden channel to a place almost unknown to her, convinced as she is that her own emotions are not the ones her life depends on. She shifts her gaze from the mother's face, back to the haircut now, so steadily, as if this short-haired girl she sees were someone else. So, it's so easy, and so much, our culture and our family help us, it is to cut off parts of ourselves and to isolate ourselves. And maybe you get some sense, maybe from the poem, of the wonderful possibility if we weren't cut off. Maybe the idea of her being a princess, we're all Buddhas in our own way. And to find the wholeness of awareness that doesn't cut anything out. So Rumi writes in a poem called The Guest House, This being human is a guest house. Every morning a new arrival. A joy, a depression, a meanness. So momentary awareness comes as an unexpected visitor. Welcome and respect them all, even if they're a crowd of sorrows who violently sweep your house, empty of its furniture, still treat each guest honorably. He may be clearing you out for some new delight. The dark thought, the shame, the malice, meet them at the door laughing and invite them in. Be grateful for whoever comes, because each has been sent as a guide. Well, that's Rumi, who's not a Buddhist, but I think in Buddhism we talk about all things being a gate. And so part of learning mindfulness practice is learning to see the gate that we can walk through and we can enter. So we learn to respect our anger also. We learn that anger is not only... Anger can be a guide in the sense that anger arises... Whenever anger arises, there's some suffering that's present. Anger wouldn't arise if there was no suffering. And the place that Buddhists are interested in, kind of the heart, the crux, the crucible of really mindfulness practice, is really understanding our suffering and the possibility of a joy that goes together with understanding suffering. And if anger arises out of suffering, if we turn away from our anger, we also turn away from understanding suffering in some form or other. And suffering in anger isn't necessarily only our personal suffering. We find ourselves often in a situation where the anger is coming at us, or which we help produce together with our friends. But whenever there's any anger, regardless of where it is, whether it's coming at you or you're directing it out or directing toward yourself or whoever, regardless of who's to blame or who's responsible, the fact is, if there's anger, there's suffering. Regardless of it's illogical or logical, the fact is, still there's suffering. So what we're interested in is not necessarily who's to blame and who's responsible so much, as we're very interested in understanding the nature of the suffering that's present there. And so part of what the gate of anger is, we walk through the gate to understand the suffering that's behind it. And we say in our culture that many of us are repressed in our anger, and we have no real experience of anger. We don't feel it, maybe. But I would say that that's probably true. But even some people who can feel their anger really well, those people then have no real experience of the component parts that make up anger. And anger is made up of many parts. And part of it is the suffering, is the hurt, the fear that can be connected to it. Part of it's humiliation, it's isolation. There's many different kind of sub-emotions or emotions that kind of come together to create this event called anger. And some of the other feeling, the tenderness that has to be there, the vulnerability, the hurt, the fear, all those things sometimes are unacceptable for us to be aware of. Men sometimes in our culture are taught it's unacceptable to be tender and vulnerable. So, if it's unacceptable to be vulnerable, how then can you look behind the anger or see with the anger there that there's some vulnerability that's present also? So we begin noticing all these different things. The fear maybe is unacceptable to be aware of. So we can feel fine feeling anger because then we're being assertive. But how about the fear behind it? Can we look at that? And then I mentioned last week that sometimes anger is a protective device in which sometimes we're trying to protect our self-integrity, our integrity. And anger arises out of many different things. But some of it actually can be to attempt to defend our integrity, our wholeness. And it's often challenged both by things we do and by things that people try to do us and the way we perceive that affecting us. And I think that we can get a sense of what it's like to violate our integrity, to cut ourselves off from ourselves so our awareness is partial and not complete. And that comes into the subject of reconciliation. Because reconciliation is an attempt, I believe, to try to repair the divisions, unhealthy divisions that might arise, either within ourselves or within our community or with other people and our friends. So I want to talk a little bit about this document that I wrote, or I helped write. One which I wrote and hasn't been edited by the community yet, by the committee. And one which was edited by the committee. It's like writing ethics by committee. So I'm on the board of directors. I have a 2-year appointment. I'm near the end now of a 2-year appointment on the board of directors of San Francisco Zen Center. And when I joined about 2 years ago, they were in the middle of a process of trying to come up with a document of ethical principles and procedures for their community. And part of it arose out of seeing that there was a real need at the Zen Center and in Buddhism in America in general to look at ethics more seriously. I think many of you know that in the 80s especially, there were a lot of ethical scandals in the Buddhist world. And earlier, before the ethical scandals, Buddhists in America hadn't really looked at ethics very much. They mostly tended to kind of dismiss it because not being important. And then they had these ethical problems. And so they started noticing, well, maybe ethics are important. And so they started studying them and paying attention to them. And then, you know, there were increasing problems. And not just problems, you know, in the Buddhist circle, but I think American religions in general had a lot of ethical dilemmas to say the least, in recent years. And a lot of it has to do with sexuality, and what the priests, the ministers, the teachers do sexually with their students. And so the Zen Center felt there was a need to come up with some principles to help understand how the community would live ethically within themselves, the principles which they felt they wanted to stand behind. And also they wanted to have some procedures for if someone had a grievance or someone felt a need for reconciliation or about some decision about them, to have some process. And I think for me, this is a very important and healthy step for American Buddhism, to be interested in such activities. And many Buddhist groups already have come up with somewhat short documents. Kanon-do has a document already, which I've seen. And so many of them are quite short, like only a page long. But for whatever reason, the San Francisco Zen Center wasn't happy with such a short document. They wanted something that really got into some of the details and some of the real issues that involve ethics and problems in the community. And at first, it seemed like what they wanted was a document for their teachers, the main teachers of the Zen Center, because a lot of the ethical real dilemmas of these communities has been around the teachers. But the community then protested and said, no, we don't want something just for the teachers, because that makes the teachers different from everybody else. We want a document that affects everybody equally, including the teachers, because we feel like we're a community of fellow practitioners, and even the teachers are fellow practitioners. And we don't want to have the sharp dividing line between teachers and students. So let's come up with a document that that is for everyone, that includes teachers in it. And so there was for 2 years they had a committee that worked on this and worked on it and worked on it. And then about a year and a half ago or so, they finished their two documents, the principles and the procedures. And they presented to the board, and the board virtually needed to have they needed to have an ethical reconciliation process just to deal with their discussion around ethics. It got really nasty. Ethics has a way of really getting people's, you know, really important issues and people's opinions and feelings and fears. It's really phenomenal. And so finally the board kind of crafted, you know, kind of tinkered with the document, and then they presented it to the community at large at San Francisco Zen Center. And there were maybe 300 people at three different meetings who read the document and discussed it. And by the time we reached the third meeting, there was a tremendous amount of hostility in the community towards the document. And it surprised the board, it surprised the people that crafted the document. And so not only had there been all these problems on the board, but it was even worse in the community. And they complained about such things that it wasn't Zen Center or Buddhist language. And in fact, the procedures part, the grievance procedures part, was lifted right out of the Jung Institute in San Francisco. So, you know, they thought that was a good model. And but there was a lot of fear in the community. People didn't know what it all meant, and they thought that it meant kind of a police state, and there was going to be this ethics police that going around and look at everybody's ethics and open doors and start, you know, doing all these horrible things. There was a lot of fear and a lot of hostility. And also there were people in the community in Zen, you know, there's a strong ancient history in Zen of being antinomian, of being against all rules and ethics and precepts, and free expression coming out of your Buddha nature. And you forget about precepts and just act freely out of your Buddha nature, your deep spiritual sense. And if you have rules, the rules are kind of artificial and constricting, and they can't really express your freedom. And kind of like maybe like the 60s a little bit. And that's, I say that partly because in the 60s there was also a kind of antinomian times. And so it was a lot of the 60s counterculture got interested in Buddhism early on. And they weren't interested in ethics because of their rebellion against it. So you had some people at the Zen Center say, this is terrible. This is not Zen to have precepts. We have to get rid of all the precepts and all ethics. And here we're dealing with, you know, teachers who are sleeping with students and all kinds of strange things going on in American Buddhism. Talk, you know, even stranger things than that. And So the board, does this interest you? I guess. I don't know. I realize I'm just talking on and on. And I guess I hadn't checked in. I got kind of, you know, and so, you know, it's about not, you know, we're not Zen here, right? So maybe you're not interested in Zen.
Well, it sounds kind of like a startup software company.
The same kind of things? They have rules and ethics there too?
They have the same kind of rebellion against them.
So it was a disaster. About last November, it was just, and people on the board were completely upset and discouraged and didn't know how to continue, how to proceed. They had these two documents that weren't acceptable. And so I went home, said, what should we do? This is terrible. And so I said, well, I'll try to do something to help. So one of the complaints was it's not in Buddhist language. So I took the principles that they had come up with, and I took the, in Zen Buddhism, they don't have five precepts. They have 10, but there's a way of counting where they get 16. So there's 16 precepts. And I said, what if we just use the 16 precepts as the skeleton for talking about the ethics or the precepts or the rules or the principles, ethical principles for the community? So I sat down and started writing this document out, rewriting it according to these 16 precepts. And then I sent it to the board and said, you know, this is an example. I sent it really as an example. This is an example of what can be done if we put it in Buddhist language. And maybe, you know, we could try to write something. This is an example of what can be done. Let's maybe get together and try to write something like this. Well, they liked what I wrote so much that they all felt very encouraged. It was like this fresh, they said it was like a current of fresh air that came in. And suddenly they felt that they could maybe continue. So at the next board meeting, they decided that they would continue. And they more or less insisted that I be on the committee and that they take the document I'd written and the committee look at it really carefully and craft it, you know, a little bit better and then bring it back to the board for consideration. So then there were four of us on the committee, five of us for a while, and we met almost weekly at times for 2 or 3 hours. And the document is only about, you know, it's only about 6 or 7 pages long. And we read, you know, each sentence we read out loud, and then we discuss and talk about and argue about, and you know, you talk about ethics. You know, it's just, and slowly, slowly, slowly. There were some days where I felt pretty discouraged with our process even. But finally, by June, we had come up with a document that the committee agreed with, and we presented to the board, and the board wasn't ready to talk about it as a board, but what I suggested was let's send it out to some of the committees in the community, the senior committees of teachers and senior staff and things, and have them review the documents and get their feedback so to include the community, and then we will proceed from there. In the meantime, we started then talking about the second document, which is the procedures for grievance and reconciliation, which is also a very important part of the document. And we had a whole series of meetings talking about all the issues that such a document should cover. And a lot of it we did was kind of fun. We did a role playing. We would imagine all these absurd, fantastic, ethical transgressions that could happen in the community. And then we would figure out what's the appropriate thing to do about it. And then we kind of, you know, talk about that for a while. And then we go on to the next one and make it up and so forth. And we talked also about a lot of the past ethical difficulties at the Zen Center and what, you know, different ways of taking care of it. So then about 2 weeks ago, I went home with all this stuff in my head and wrote this document. And I was so pleased how quickly it took me to write. I thought it would take forever because I don't know anything about stuff. I know very little about these things. It's kind of an accident, I feel like I fell into it. And I know not less about grievance procedures and reconciliation, I know about ethics. And here I'm writing this document. So what I thought I would like to do now is read a little bit in both documents to give you a sense of what the documents are like. So this is from the introduction to the principles. The Buddhist precepts are so intimate a part of Zen practice, or I'm going to change, every time it comes to Zen, I'm going to change it to Buddhist, because I wrote it for the Zen Center, but actually, you know, I feel good about this being a Buddhist document. And since I wrote it, the Buddhist precepts are so intimate a part of Buddhist practice that they have traditionally been called the blood vein of the ancestral lineage. Because the precepts arise within the world of interdependence, emptiness, and Buddha nature, there are many ways of understanding and levels of interpreting the precepts. They can be understood as supports for the practice of awakening, as the arena of that practice, and as the expression of awakening itself. While Buddhist precepts are sometimes understood from relative and sometimes from absolute points of view, for example, that the precepts are never fully accomplished or that they are always fulfilled, there is no Buddhist practice without basing one's actions on the Buddhist precepts. The community life of Zen Center, as an integral part of our practice, is likewise based on these Bodhisattva precepts. In order to help create a supportive, harmonious, and safe environment within our Sangha for everyone's practice, we have here outlined the significant ways in which these precepts guide and inform our community life. And then it goes into the 16 precepts. And one of the 16 precepts is to take refuge in the Sangha. And this is what the document says. In taking refuge in Sangha, we acknowledge the central role that Zen Center community life has in our practice. Since part of taking refuge is the offering of refuge, we aim to create within Zen Center a supportive and inclusive environment for everyone's engagement in the Bodhisattva way. Thus, it is essential that we encourage open, ongoing communication at the deepest possible levels among all residential and non-residential Sangha members, and that any ethical concerns or conflicts which arise are fully heard and addressed by the community in an appropriate forum. One of the 16 precepts is the precepts to do good. Seems like a pretty inclusive. To do good, this is to uncover and to act from the loving kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy, and equanimity of our awakened nature. In our effort to live ethically, confession, repentance, and forgiveness are time-honored Buddhist practices that involve cultivating the good. And now we get into the precepts themselves. Not to steal. This precept expresses the Bodhisattva's commitment to live from a generous heart rather than from an avaricious mind. At a personal level, avaricious behavior harms the person who steals. On a community level, stealing can harm or even destroy the opportunity and the environment for Buddhist practice. The real reason for writing all this was to talk about sex. And I'm going to say it honestly. I mean, if it wasn't for sexual transgression and trying to take care of them, this document would never have been written. And the part that had the most discussion, the most difficulty in the community was the part about sexuality, and especially teachers and what they could do. And it's a little bit complicated at the Zen Center because it's a residential community, and people live together there for 10 or 20 years together. And so the relationships are not exactly so black and white as, for example, with a therapist and a client, or with a priest maybe who has, where you visit the priest on Sunday or whatever. People's lives overlap and are very intimate in many, many different levels. So it was very complicated to figure out the sexual ethics for that community. But I'll just read the one section, the key section about teachers. It is considered a misuse of authority and responsibility for a Zen Center teacher to engage in sexual behavior with her or his student. If either teacher or student find themselves at risk of violating this guideline, they should suspend their teacher-student relationship until they have sought counsel with a senior Zen Center teacher. Furthermore, it is considered a misuse of sexuality for a teacher at Zen Center to form a sexual relationship with a former student within 6 months of the termination of the student-teacher relationship. In addition, before forming a sexual relationship, all Zen Center teachers, priests, head students, or any person in a formal role that may entail clear advantages of status over others should discuss the appropriateness of the potential relationship with their teacher or a practice leader. The precept not to lie. The precept not to lie is particularly important for the community life of a practicing sangha. While ethical transgressions can occur around any of the precepts, many of these difficulties would not arise if there were not an element of deceit involved. Lying to oneself, to another, or to one's community obscures the nature of reality and hinders the intention of bodhisattva practice. Within our community life, lying can also entail the deliberate withholding of information. One of the precepts in Zen is not to praise oneself at the expense of others. So it says, while rejoicing in one's own good qualities and deeds is a time-honored Buddhist practice, praising oneself or seeking personal gain at the expense of others arises out of a misunderstanding of the interdependent nature of self. Another of the precepts is not to harbor ill will. Any deviation from loving kindness is an important cue that we may have lost touch with our own integrity and the Buddha nature of others. And this, I think, is a real key to the precepts and to understanding anger and ill will and all these things, is that all these things are a cue that we've lost touch with our own integrity, perhaps. And so, rather than being critical of them, we welcome them, like Rumi says, because they're messengers that something perhaps is amiss. And certainly with ill will, I think we've lost touch with it. So that's the, you know, the principles. I mean, there's a lot more details. Those are kind of the general statements around each precept. And then a few things about reconciliation. And I think that reconciliation is, the Zen Center community was very concerned about reconciliation. The underlying value of the community that most people share is that reconciliation has the highest value, and that all attempts should be tried to make to reconcile conflicts rather than to kick someone out of Zen Center or to remain in conflict or remain isolated from each other or separate. And I think that's the way it should be. I think in Buddhist practice, reconciliation is always the attempt to try to find the common ground, the mutual understanding that allows for some kind of realignment and harmony and friendship. And it's possible to have friendship even when there's disagreement. We want our life within the Zen Center Sangha to both support and express our Zen practice and Bodhisattva intention. Thus, when conflict, grievance, hurt, or dissonance arise in our interpersonal relationships, it is important to attend to these fully. Tending to interpersonal difficulties is not a distraction from Buddhist practice. It is Buddhist practice when we encounter them. Personally, this involves waking up to our own contribution to the suffering through understanding our reactions, emotions, and attachments. Interpersonally, this involves taking the time to discuss the conflict with the others involved in an attempt to clarify the actual causes, conditions, feelings, and responses that came together in the situation. As the Bodhisattva path is a heartfelt response to suffering, turning away or skimming over suffering through avoidance, rationalization, assigning blame, feeling self-deprecating guilt, or not listening deeply to the causes and conditions is to turn away from the Bodhisattva path itself. Furthermore, Avoidance is often a condition for additional suffering. So there's two parts to this procedures document. Is it working for me to read? Is it okay? I'm being quite the same response as before, but I'll continue anyway. There's two parts to this document. There is, to the procedures part, there's a formal grievance and reconciliation process that is very, not as legalistic as the earlier document, but very step by step, because we feel that if someone really has a strong concern, they might even be traumatized out of some terrible thing that happened to them, they need very clear guidelines of how to petition or apply for some kind of process of either reconciliation or of complaint. Sometimes reconciliation actually is not maybe possible, and so rather they need an avenue for complaining. So it's a very formal procedure. But the Zen Center community wanted to try very much to avoid formal grievance complaints, because the feeling is that formal procedures will never really help with the interpersonal difficulty. You can't really get reconciliation with a very, very formal kind of legalistic process. So the encouragement is to try to cultivate a culture within the Zen Center where people are willing and have skills in mediation, in working with each other around difficulties and conflicts and angers and whatever might arise. So the first part of the document is five guidelines for resolving conflicts and disagreements more kind of informally. So these five are being heard, stating the actual, confession, facilitation, and seeking advice. And it's exactly 9 o'clock. So maybe there isn't time, maybe some other time I can read those or talk more about them. But I think that Sangha, to end up, what a Sangha is, what a Buddhist community of fellow practitioners is, it's not only a community that shares a practice, but it's also a community that's involved in a process of mutual understanding. And a Sangha is not necessarily a community which agrees with everything, or not even necessarily a community that necessarily gets along completely. But it's a group of people that are willing to practice together regarding the differences, and willing to engage each other and talk to each other about what the differences are, so that to help each other not to be isolated, and to help each other kind of deal with suffering and the freedom of suffering, which is what Buddhism offers. So this I hold this a very high value, and it was a real pleasure for me, an honor I felt, to have been included this last while at the Zen Center in making this contribution to them. And they've been around for 35 years, I guess, for a long time, and they're getting around to doing this now. They're a large enough organization, and my hope is that this document becomes something that other Buddhist groups in the country would find interesting to look at, and maybe also maybe you learn some things from. So thank you all for tonight, and I hope this was useful and interesting.